May it please the court, Mr. Tom Morris will present arguments with petitioners. Petitioners have reserved 5 minutes for rebuttal.
May it please the court, as always, it's a pleasure to be before this court. And I'd like to bring to life a dry bones oil and gas case, if I can. There is, in this alleged drainage case, as in any damage suit, the plaintiff must not only prove that he sustained damages or that they sustained damages, but also the amount of those damages with reasonable certainty by competent evidence. Your Honor?
This type of suit has been brought for a long time.
It has been, but there's been a lot of differences in them, Your Honor.
Right.
And there's a lot of differences.
You're saying that Free Dollar, Free Roberts, Free Robinson, Free Hamill, their case might be all right, and now it's not because of those changes, or are you saying this case would have been
I don't think it would have ever been a good case under Texas law. Certainly not since Schaefer versus Texas Employers, in which this court squarely held that the mere fact that an expert says it's based on reasonable medical probability, it has probative value when it doesn't have any factual foundation for it. So I think we go way back before Daubert. The broad issue, of course, is whether there is any legally sufficient evidence to support a finding of damages. That's the broad issue. The underlying issue, though, is what amount of gas would the well have produced? Only one witness testified on that, their expert, Michael Riley. He opined that the protection well would have produced 6.1 BCF of gas, and plaintiff's royalty share would have been over $2 million. We challenged his opinion because it did not have a reliable factual foundation. We challenged it by motion to strike. We challenged it by numerous motions for judgment, all of which were overruled. At the close of my cross-examination, when I had an adequate foundation laid to challenge his opinion, I moved to strike it at that point, Your Honor.
And then there was a redirect. There was opportunity for redirect after your motion.
3 days of opportunity thereafter. This occurred on the second day of trial, and plaintiffs had 3 days after that in which to restructure their case if they could.
But, I mean, at your cross, you made this motion, and then he gave redirect that they asked further questions of him.
Not only redirect, but they also recalled him later on. Right, now, the law on this is just absolutely clear. There can't be any doubt about it any longer. That an expert's opinion, in order to be admissible, he must not only be qualified, it must be reliable. And to be reliable, it must have a reliable factual foundation and reliable methodology. That essentially was held in the Schaefer case 14 years before Daubert. Then came Daubert, then came Robinson in this court, and the numerous cases since then which have repeated and repeated and repeated that rule. We challenged Mr. Riley's opinion because it did not have a factual foundation. Now, in order to orient that, I need to give the court just a little bit of background history. The Upper Mara Formation in the Anadarko Basin in the Texas Panhandle, particularly the south part of it, is over 300 million years old and is 15 to 16,000 feet deep. It's generally accepted it was laid down in stream beds in narrow deposits here and there. They're hard to find, and when you find them, they may or may not be productive. Don Wilson, Kerr McGee's senior geologist in 1991-1993, developed a prospect by examining the records of scores of wells in the south part of the Anadarko Basin, and came up with a prospect where he thought there was an opportunity, possible opportunity, for Puryear formation in the Upper Marl. And he visualized the stream beds in that particular area as running generally north from southwest to northeast. After having examined all of that, he located the first well in section 17 in the northwest corner of it. Placed here. Lo and behold, he hit it square on the button. A prolific producer was developed, but it was in a new zone of the Upper Marl, which had previously been unknown, called the Lower Puryear.
Then immediately thereafter that, Kerr McGee drilled 8 more wells in that field, which was called the West Park Field. 8 more wells, trying to define and develop the Lower Prairie Formation. The Fleetwood Trust well, which is somewhat southwest from Holmes, turned out also to be a prolific producer, considerably better than Holmes. Every other well in the entire zone was unproductive insofar as the Lower Prairie Formation was concerned. 2 wells in the plated section 10, Mitchell 10-1 and Mitchell 10-2. Mitchell 10-1 had none. Mitchell 10-2 had about 7 feet with poor porosity. It was non-commercial. Eden 11-1 across the corner to the northwest had 7 feet with poor porosity and was non-commercial. All of the rest of the wells had no productive Lower Prairie Formation. Now that's what we were dealing with as far as geology is concerned.
How did Mr. Riley get to his opinion?
Did Kerr's testimony or information indicate a 60-foot...
Dr. Dennis Kerr opined, and he was incidentally a professor who had no experience in the Anadarko Basin at all, but he opined that a well at where Mr. Riley proposed it, as close as legally possible to the Holmes well, that it would have had 60 feet of Lower Prairie Formation. He didn't know any of its other qualifications except that he thought it would be reservoir quality. But he defined reservoir quality as any reservoir which formation which simply has sufficient porosity to hold gas and sufficient permeability to move the gas. That was what he defined as reservoir quality.
Do you take issue with the 60-foot depth?
I accept it for purposes of argument in this court. I take issue with it strongly. But for this court, I accept it as, okay, we have 60 feet there.
If there were 60 feet, of all the factors that you list in your brief that can influence productivity, it looks at if the hypothetical well were over 60 feet of thickness, that at least its production would be in relation to the Holmes and Fleetwood wells, bear that same relation.
Well, I disagree with that entirely, Your Honor.
80
foot in Fleetwood, 70 feet in Holmes, 70 feet
and
plus.
So why wouldn't the hypothetical well produce relative to those two the same relationship that the thickness board goes over?
Because we know nothing about its other characteristics, that we have no knowledge whatsoever as to what its other characteristics might be, such as its permeability, its porosity, its water saturation, and so on, the factors that affect production of a well. And you have to extrapolate those in some manner by the use of data. You can't just pull it out of the air. You can't say, well, that's a good well over here. The formation must extend up here, and therefore I ought to get a well just as good as old wells. You can't do that.
Can you ever win one?
Well, certainly you can win one. You've got to do your homework, and you've got to analyze the factors and do the proper interpolation of how those relate to this.
Every one of these other wells has been a huge producer, every well up there.
No, you couldn't even do it then, Your Honor, because you have to get well data. You have to have some points of data in order to determine those things. And even Dr. Kerr admitted that he had no well data north of this line right here by which to extend this formation at all. He had no well data. He had to do it simply on the generality that the trend was north, and therefore this formation ought to trend up there, and it ought to be there, and it ought to be 60 feet thick.
Okay.
That's how he got there.
So nice. I'll be clear. North of which line?
Excuse me. North of the line between Eden 11-1 and Mitchell 10-1, both of which were bummers. 7 feet, no porosity, no production. 7 feet, no porosity, no production. So what is this one going to have? Is it going to have 7 feet, no porosity, no production? Or is it going to have 60 feet, big porosity, big production like these wells down here?
Let me ask you a question. Without actually drilling a well, say in 1999 or so, if that was a supposed hypothetical well, any way for that plaintiff's expert, Mr. Riley, to obtain the necessary data, like you're talking about, with sufficient reliability. I mean, like Chief Stokes was talking about, anybody witnesses like this, and if so, what's his data?
We provided him with all the data of all of the wells, Your Honor, and you can take the logs from all of those, and study the trends, and determine what there ought to be in taking some averages, some reasonable averages of what it might be in that particular hole. But he can't be exact, and you can't expect him to be exact. But you must make a reasonable effort to determine what that well would be. But now let's examine how Mr. Riley got there. He didn't do any of that. He didn't use any of those factors. All he did was step over here and take the production from Holmes and the production from Fleetwood, or let me get them correct, Holmes and Fleetwood, and say that the hypothetical well ought to be as good as those. And he did a production forecast, a prepared production forecast graph, which I placed on the easel and they're in the appendix, in which he showed those three wells as declining at precisely the same rate. You just follow the straight lines, you get Holmes production for the first year, then you get Holmes plus the hypothetical well with the same line, and then you get Holmes plus Fleetwood plus the hypothetical well all on exactly the same line. Well, anybody with an ounce of sense about the oil and gas business, and particularly in the Anadarko Basin, knows that the wells do not, no two wells would decline at precisely the same rate, but that's what he based his opinion on. Now, what's wrong with that? It's contrary. Not only is it not supported by any facts, it's absolutely contrary to the facts that we know. And the facts that we know concern the two producing wells, Fleetwood and Holmes. And let me give you a run through what they show. Holmes had 70 feet, Fleetwood had 80 feet. Their permeabilities from the record, their porosities from the records were about the same. Their water saturations from the record were about the same. Initial open flow of Holmes was 10,800 MCF with a virgin pressure, starting with a virgin pressure of 8,000 PSI. Fleetwood, starting 3 years later with a depleting reservoir with 400 PSI pressure, had 12,000 MCF initial open flow at that time, 3 years later. Second, production in April 1997, when Fleetwood went on stream, Holmes produced 83,000 plus MCF. Fleetwood produced 399,000 MCF, over four times as much as Holmes. During 7 years, Holmes produced 8.7 BCF of gas, and Fleetwood, in 4 years, produced 7 BCF of gas. In September 1999, Holmes ceased production. Fleetwood, during that month, produced 85,000 MCF and was still producing at the time of trial in March 2001. So those are absolute positive proof that the assumption which Mr. Riley used to formulate his opinion is not only unfounded, it is contrary to the facts. And as this court said in Burris Welcome versus Cry, when an expert's opinion is not only unfounded, but is contrary to the undisputed facts, it is unreliable, has no probative value, and constitutes no evidence to support a finding.
I'm still trying to get a bigger picture. In your position, the geology here is so fundamental, and the variances of the thickness and such are so great that you could never prove a case in this field. Or is it your position that there might be a case here, but the plans have not proved it because the assumptions and the things that testified manifest on their face that it proves on their face?
I say, Your Honor, had they taken a different attack and analyzed all of the known factors and done a reasonable extrapolation from those factors, as engineers do, then they could have presented a reasonably believable case. But when they base their case upon facts which are not true and are proven to be untrue.
There's dry holes in the area, or the mere fact that this is a tough formation to crack, doesn't
Absolutely not. Of course you can prove you can get a drainage case if you do your homework and study it and prepare the scientific proof on it, which wasn't done in this case. But you can't stand over here and say, okay, I'm here in section 10 in this corner, and there's the Holmes well right down there 1,100 feet, which is producing 7 million feet a day, and we can volumetrically calculate the reservoir. And that reservoir ought to come up here to this spot, and this well ought to be as good as those. That's nothing in the world but a layman's close knowledge. That doesn't even come close to any kind of scientific proof.
Any other questions? Yeah, any damages expert from your own?
Yeah, we had our own people, and I'm ignoring all of our folks.
Well, what was his opinion?
His opinion was that it would have produced about a million, 103.
A net profit?
Excuse me?
Net profit?
A net profit about, royalty to them, been about $132,000. That's the kind of well that he figures you'd get here. Probably the well would never produce enough to pay out.
Not to pay out anything?
Never pay out, pay even the drilling costs. Would never even produce enough to pay the drilling costs.
And what added did you allow?
Excuse me, and that amount was $1,600,000.
What added did you allow?
The same data. All of the well data. All of the geological data that was presented.
Any other questions?
Thank you. Thank you.
May it please the court, Mr. Otis Shearer will present arguments for the respondent.
May it please the court. The issue before you is whether there is any evidence in the record to support the damage findings of the trial court. And on that issue, what is not contested on appeal impacts what is. Factors not contested, findings of fact that are uncontested for purposes of this appeal, are that a reasonably prudent operator would have drilled at this location, that it would have paid out in a reasonable time, that's the $1,000,006 of damages, of actual expense to drill and complete, and that that well, over and above that expense, would have made a reasonable profit. Now, it's uncontradicted that the drilling cost is $1.6 million, and what Mr. Riley, the engineer called by the mineral owners, did was to compare the Holmes well, and this is only 1,127 feet north of the Holmes where the proposed well was, to protect from drainage. I might approach the chart there. Well, you can see the number one well. In fact, there's a dot right there. 1,127 feet is what was proposed for the offset location.
Well, these wells seem to perform differently based on the thickness. Did Mr. Bradley take that into consideration in his calculation regarding the specimen?
Yes, he did.
So he thought if you had 60 foot thickness, that would be a lot less than 70 or 80.
Standing alone, he did. In cross-examination, counsel asked him, standing alone, is that so? But Mr. Riley said there are other factors to consider, too. One item is skin damage. The Holmes well had drilling fluids get into the productive zone, and that impedes that flow of the hydrocarbons through the productive zone. And the thought was that steps could be taken to avoid that problem in the protection well, and it could very well be better than the Holmes. Now, the question is, one question is it a reasonable approach to look at the Holmes and compare how it produced in making a damage calculation? And
let me back up to make sure I understand. If it is a reasonable approach to do that, then Riley equated the hypothetical well with the Holmes. I mean, did he say, this will do what Holmes did or better?
He did. He said it would do equal for purposes of calculations.
And it looks like that a lot of these factors, just looking at them on the paper, and as all the parties have said, maybe the judge is not knowing anything about the ordinary layman, the big difference is with thickness. Why would he think this matter with respect to the hypothetical? Why would he think it's less of a pollution?
Thickness matters, also permeability matters. But the question is, when you don't know all the facts that you'd like to know, and you've got to decide whether to drill, again, it's given that a reasonably prudent operator would have drilled, and we have a non-judicial use made of the approach taken by Mr. Riley, the engineer. And unfortunately, we did not put this in our brief or appendix, and I have it before you now. It's Defendant's Exhibit 119. It's a study commissioned by Kerr McGee by a Houston firm called Reservoir Description Services. This is done after the Holmes came in and while they were drilling the second well before it was completed, the Mitchell 10-1. And they have two scenarios on the effect of a second well in this reservoir. And the first scenario is a conservative forecast of having the two wells, the Holmes and the next well, being in the same productivity index, having the same productive capacity. We say this is particularly important in view of the uncontested findings that this well would have been profitable. The question is this a reasonable way of projecting damages? And Kerr McGee, a second well. At this time, they were drilling. The facts were that the 10-1 was being drilled when this study took place. But we say the same theory should apply when you move much closer to the Holmes well and improve your chances of getting into that reservoir. It was done while the Mitchell was being drilled. It doesn't really state the location. It just says a second well in the reservoir. Well, they assume it's going to be productive. And they are studying here the effect of a productive second well on the reservoir. And
but neither of the Mitchell wells was.
Yes, but this one is, for purposes of this appeal, where this well would have been. There's no contest to the fact that this well, the protection well we're talking about, would have made a profit.
Well, here's what I'm going to follow. If you say this is a reasonable approach, and it's projected that the Mitchell well would be a producer, and it wasn't, how is it a reasonable approach?
It's not saying the Mitchell well, although that well was drilling. It's saying if a well was productive, a second well was productive, and we have the uncontradicted finding that would have been productive and profitable. So therefore, when you're looking at the issue before this court, is this approach reasonable in estimating damages? Well, this is a non-judicial use of this approach made by Kerr McGee. And this approach has been done over the years, too, by we cite cases in our brief where for years, obviously, how else are you going to prove up a case like this other than go to the neighboring wells and get the information on it?
When you saw these wells come in, Home 71, did you have the option to see utilization?
Kerr McGee may have had that option had they had the leases permitted. Sometimes leases will restrict unitization, but with no lease restrictions, Kerr McGee could have come in and drawn a unit different than what they did. What they did do is to come in and say all of Section 17, where the Holmes is situated, is a unit, and all of Section 10, which is my client's land, is a unit. That's the facts we're doing. Well, I don't know. I think a 640 unit is a standard unit for this type of gas well, and that's what these are. But they could have drawn them other than all of sections. Yeah.
I had a question. Your brief states that you allowed the trial court to rule and deny the defendant's motion to strike Riley's damages testimony. If the motion to strike had been granted, what would the plaintiff or expert have done at trial to prove the reliability of the damages?
if the motion to strike had been granted, what would we have done to try to overcome that? We could have...
You're asking for a remand.
Yes. Because there's some, obviously, some damages here. It's uncontested that it would have made a reasonable profit. And this court has seen a trend in your cases where this court has remanded where there's evidence of some damages, even though the proof may have not have met the Daubert test. As far as the scientific proof, the engineer could have gone about it a little different, obviously. On the second time around, I'm sure the engineering testimony would be somewhat different. But the fact is, the finding of this court is a very conservative one. This finding says that a second well in the reservoir that's equal to the Holmes would be a very conservative forecast. Then it doubled what the Holmes did and said that's only a slightly less conservative and still very conservative. Now, this Fleetwood Trust, when it came on, it dominated the Holmes. But the trial court's findings are fully supported by what would have happened in the field before Fleetwood Trust came on play. We have a 2-year window there, and the trial court, in effect, awarded about 60% of the 2-year damages that were calculated by Mr. Riley in the engineering. So we have a very conservative projection in the study, and the trial court even took it far more conservative than that was. So we have a very conservative finding of the trial court that's well within the evidence supplied by the engineer. It's not just guesswork on his part. He took the same approach that Kerr McGee commissioned in that study.
Does that mean then that if these two wells and the hypothetical well had produced in relation to the thickness of the lower corner of the truck, that there still would have been as much damage as the tropical effect?
Oh, there have been far more. You say two wells. You mean the protection well and the home. So you'd have the two?
Yeah, if the protection well, the hypothetical well, the homes and the fleet had all produced, had their production been relative to the thickness of the formation they encountered, 80 feet for the fleet wood, 70
for the homes,
and 60 for the hypothetical well, and they have produced, their production had been in direct relation to that thickness, so that porosity and other factors did not affect it. Would the damages be more or less than what the trial court found?
I think they'd be more. I think the trial court was very conservative on this damage finding. As I mentioned, you can ignore the Fleetwood time of production. This award's fully supported by pre-Fleetwood in the 2-year window. Kerr McGee, you know, the motion to strike really was centered on the subject of the engineer not knowing exactly how the protection well will turn out. You know, there's some, while geologists can draw the lines, you never know till you drill. And the engineer had to admit that. Now, I don't know what the permeability will be. I don't know what the depth will be. I can only make reasonable projections. Well, Kerr McGee's position is, without making those precise projections, it's speculation and the landowner cannot recover. And if that's a law, here's the effect of it. Kerr McGee, as in this case, has a clear duty to drill. It owns all the leases in the area. It has a conflict of interest. Why would it drill 1.6 million well and it's going to get the gas anyway? So it refuses to do its duty. Landowner sues and says, well, you can't prove how this well would have turned out. Therefore, you lose. And that's, in effect, asking for an immunity from a clear...
Why didn't your expert look at all the other wells?
He did. Oh, he did. In fact, he commissioned another engineer to do a study on porosity. And he used that information in projecting the size of the field and how much had been drawn. He did a pressure and production study using all the field, all the zones in this area, in this zone, which was the Fleetwood Trust and the Holmes. And Mitchell 10-2, by the way, was a second well drilled over here, and it had a little bit, 7 feet or so of this pay, and it was in pressure communication. and the engineers used his study too. And he considered all that in coming up with his damage calculations as plaintiff's Exhibit 21.
But even the Court of Appeals thing that says that Ryder testified he looked at all these wells and their production, but that was not telling. And he has no idea, based on those, what this hypothetical well was.
It's not as a matter, I don't think, there's no idea, is that he can't tell you precisely.
Yes, he has absolutely no factual data on which to support that opinion, do you? And he says the only fact I have to base it on is what the wells in the immediate area are producing. Then the question, well, that does not tell you what the hypothetical well will produce, does it? And his answer is no, it does not. So, but how do we evaluate that testimony in terms of the liability if he can't even say the comparison would be relevant to what the hypothetical well is?
Well, this gets back to the perfect defense or the applied immunity that they want. There's no way of knowing exactly the thickness of the pay or the permeability until you drill. And if the standard of proof and damages for a mineral owner is to have that type of precision, then there will be no more of these cases. The land mineral owners will not be able to bring these cases because you never know till you drill. Engineers have to make estimates and projections.
We have a case here where one expert looks at 10 wells and says it's not going to pay, but not in the business. What does a trial judge do if the objection is to get on Robinson and other standards? What factors do you look at?
You look at what a reasonably prudent operator would do and the type of studies that they would make, and we have a non-judicial use made of this approach.
Do you think it was error for, you don't have to have objected, but was it error for the trial judge to allow the term of the experts?
Oh, there's no objection to.
I know you didn't object, but could you have success?
I don't think so. I think both sides are entitled to come into court and give their views, and trier of the fact resolves it.
But wasn't this what the U.S. Supreme Court has been trying to narrow, I guess, is having two experts come in with radically different explanations for everything?
Of course, we're dealing, the big battleground is whether or not it's productive. You know, whether or not this well would have been successful and made a profit. And that's not an issue in this appeal. In this case, it's uncontested for purposes of appeal. It would have made a reasonable profit. So again, starting at that point, under this record, we're looking at the amount of damages again. And we say that the non-judicial use of computing damages made on the basis of what the neighboring wells are producing is a reasonable approach. It's one that's been sanctioned by the courts throughout Texas through many years. And we say Daubert and Gamel doesn't change that. Again, this court in Robinson looked very carefully at the non-judicial use.
Sure, let me ask you. I'm hoping you can answer this question. What pieces of information, Moore says that your expert didn't use information that an expert would use in order to come to the conclusion that he claims to have come to. And so this is a no factual foundation for the opinion that was relied on. What information do you understand from Kern McGee to be their concern that your expert should have used what he did? You understand my question?
Yes, their objection, their motion to strike sets it out. He said that and their cross-examination that they rely on in support of that motion, that our engineer could not predict precisely what the depth, what the thickness of the pay would be, or what the permeability. That's the standard that Kerr McGee would have us meet, and we can't meet it.
Well, now, the argument there is that because he necessarily has to speculate, they're requiring you to actually drill the well in order to have the answer. And I think I agree. You don't have to drill the well. But it seems to me, between the two of you, some operator drills wells based on some piece of information that's purely speculation, but it's an educated guess. What piece of information does Kern McGee say you don't have that you should have used before we can allow your witness to give an educated guess on this?
I don't see the factual background that we're missing.
So what you're saying is there is no factual information missing from your expert's decision that was private of what an operator considered an educated guess.
And indeed, Mr. Riley has had 25 years experience with a drilling company. He points out that you have to drill to protect from drainage a lot of times without knowing all the available information. Millions of dollars are invested by operators in the field.
In fact, isn't that what Kermit Dee's done?
Yes.
And they put millions of dollars.
But what they were doing on those Mitchell, especially the 10-1, the first step out well, they were looking for a separate pod, it would seem. Evidence was these longitudinal bars kind of close. We say they weren't looking at protecting from drainage on the Holmes well, they were looking for the next pod that would go in that direction, the general geological trend.
If Riley had testified that the hypothetical well would have been five times the producer of Fleetwood well, would that have been underlined? Or is that just something to cross the Panama and attack the credibility?
Well, I tell you, I think this very report shows that five times may not be beyond the realm of possibilities. They point out this skin damage problem in this report that's in the Holmes, say that hopefully skin damage won't be a concern in the new well and that the rates will be greater than the current status.
Well, that's a complete.
Okay.
You said five times
produced. Oh, okay.
Is that reliable, or is that just something to call the status?
That is a little hard to accept. He didn't say that.
Well, I guess what I'm getting is an expert testifying in this area could get so far afield of the underlying data that his report would then become unreliable, even if he was going about the analysis the same place it was.
If his conclusion gets too far away, you get the Gamow gap problem there, and I don't think we've reached by any means here. Oh, yes.
So
both.
Well, the trial judge awarded you 10-0 or double what you got here. Do you believe that's essentially an unreviewable?
I think it's within the range of evidence presented to the trial court, and he came on the conservative side of it. Kermit Gee came out very well on actual damages here.
One last question. This motion to strike, which has been made, was literally only addressed to the factual foundation of Riley's testimony, and you claim in your briefs that therefore they waived regarding his methodology. Is that basically protected? Is that correct?
Yes, we say they waived that.
So can you describe for me kind of lay the term what methodology you're trying to protect? Is it just the fact they average these wells, or is there more to it?
Yes, basically that the methodology of doing like the reservoir description services, you kind of compare the protection well and the second well in the reservoir as having volume similar to that first well. That's a methodology that I don't think and indeed when you look at the factual background part, I think there's no dispute on the facts used by Mr. Riley. I think he used the proper facts. It's a matter of the conclusion reached from those facts.
May it please the court, I thought we made it clear in our briefs, and I want to make it clear again. We don't admit any of the matters that he says are uncontested and undisputed. We assume facts for purposes of narrowing the issues in this court. We contested them vigorously. We simply elected to pursue the appeal based on the proof of damages issue. And that's all that's before this. That's what we presented to this court. Second thing I want to address is that this court, nor any other court, can make a comparative finding unless there is a reliable expert opinion from which to draw it. And if there is no reliable expert opinion, then the trial court and the intermediate court and this court is powerless to make any finding because there is no evidence to support a finding. And that's the case here. Now then, what Mr. Riley could have done seems to be troubling the court somewhat.
Let's look at our data. Kerbage exploded. Holmes a good well. In the plaintiff's section, first well, dry hole. No reservoir going up there. Second well, Eden across the corner to the northwest. No lower perimeter. No formation. No reservoir going up there. Second well in plaintiff's section, Mitchell 10-2. Only 7 feet of formation, non-productive. The reservoir, a productive reservoir, didn't extend up there. And no other projection except Fleetwood shows us where there was commercial good for commercial production. Now then, an expert can do some interpolation from those things and say, this was poor porosity and poor thickness. This was poor porosity and poor thickness. Therefore, this well between the two might be better, more likely would be closer to those. Maybe we can take some averages of some kind. And had he attempted to do that, then we might have some data to work with. He didn't try to do that. He proceeded on one basis only. That is to compare the production of the two productive wells, the only two productive wells, and say that the hypothetical well would be as good as both of them, would produce at the same rate as both of them, and would decline at the same rate as both of them.
I thought you told me, I thought, that they get a pressure in production from those, and also looking at porosity also.
If he did, he didn't put it in evidence, Your Honor. There's not one iota of evidence as to how they tried to arrive at opinion except on one basis, and one basis only, and that is a comparison of the production of Holmes and Fleetwood, and assume that the hypothetical well would be as good as Holmes and as good as Fleetwood.
But didn't take into consideration the fact that he had some geologists tell them in ancient times that proposed hypothetical well would be like 25 feet or so above the existing wells, and that it would flow down, there would be a certain amount of water.
There's an elevation difference, 25 feet. You can calculate that from the structural maps that were presented in evidence. You can figure that, and that might have some effect on how soon the well would water out. He didn't rely on it. He said that's a factor that could be taken into consideration. But that's not what he relied on. He relied on a comparison of two wells. And what those wells did proved that his reliance is false. It's an assumption that is unsupported by fact. And when an assumption is unsupported by fact, as this court said in Cry, it won't fly. It's non-probative, and the opinion is no evidence to support a finding.
Mark,
thank you, Your Honor.
Your exhibits, the exhibits by your opponents, 21 and 16.
Yes, sir, the two, the one, 21, which is a calculation, and 16, 17, and 18, which are his projections, and I have placed those on the bench before the Your Honor, yes, what's the question about?
Did you object to that?
I did not, because those are nothing but paper expressions of opinion. I objected to his opinion, and that's what his tabulations are, his opinion of what the well would produce and how he got there. And so the objection to his opinion goes to all of his opinion evidence.
All right, so you don't, I take it then by that, you don't think that underpins or gives any reliability to supports his testimony?
Absolutely not. When you say my opinion is such and I base it on this, it doesn't have a foundation, the fact that I put it on paper doesn't strengthen it any.
All right. Oh yay, oh yay, oh yay. The Honorable Supreme Court of Texas now stands adjourned.